Question. If follow your passion is bad advice, what should you do instead? It contended that the traits that define great work are rare and valuable. If you want these traits in your own life, you need rare and valuable skills to offer in return. I called these rare and valuable skills career capital, and noted that the foundation of constructing work you love is acquiring a large store of this capital. With this in mind, we turned our attention to this process of capital acquisition. I argued that it's important to adopt the craftsman mindset, where you focus relentlessly on what value you're offering the world. This stands in stark contrast to the much more common passion mindset, which has you focus only on what value the world is offering you. Even with the craftsman mindset, however, becoming so good they can't ignore you is not trivial. To help these efforts, I introduced the well-studied concept of deliberate practice, an approach to work where you deliberately stretch your abilities beyond where you're comfortable, and then receive ruthless feedback on your performance. Musicians, athletes, and chess players know all about deliberate practice. Knowledge workers, however, do not. This is great news for knowledge workers. If you can introduce this strategy into your working life, you can vault past your peers in your acquisition of career capital. Rule number 3. Turn down a promotion, or the importance of control. Chapter 8. The Dream Job Elixir. In which I argue that control over what you do and how you do it is one of the most powerful traits you can acquire when creating work you love. The Mysterious Red Fire Appeal. When Ryan Voylan graduated college in 2000 with an Ivy League diploma in hand, he didn't follow his classmates into the big city banks or management consultancies. Instead, he did something unexpected. He bought farmland. Ryan's acreage is in Granby, Massachusetts, a small town of 6,000 in the center of the state, not far south from Amherst. The land quality in Granby is mixed. It's too far east from the Connecticut River to guarantee access to the river valley's best soil. But Ryan still managed to coax a variety of fruits and vegetables out of his plot. He called the fledgling concern Red Fire Farm. When I arrived in May 2011 to spend a day at Red Fire, Ryan, who was now working with his wife Sarah, had 70 acres of organic produce under cultivation. The bulk of Red Fire's revenues comes from their Community Supported Agriculture, CSA, program, in which subscribers pay for a share of the farm's output at the beginning of the growing season and then pick up their produce every week at distribution stands throughout the state. In 2011, the program had around 1,300 CSA subscribers and had started to turn people away. There was more demand than they could meet. In other words, Red Fire Farm is a success, but this is not what drew me to Granby. I arranged to spend a day with Ryan and Sarah for a more personal reason. I wanted to figure out why their lifestyle was so appealing. To clarify, I'm not the only one entranced by Red Fire. This is a farm with fans. When Ryan and Sarah arrange special events throughout the year, a dinner to celebrate the summer strawberry harvest, for example, or their fall pumpkin festival, they quickly sell out. During my last visit, I overheard a middle-aged woman tell her friend, "I just love Ryan and Sarah, and I'm pretty sure they'd never actually met." The idea of Ryan and Sarah and what their lifestyle represents was enough to draw her to Granby. This appeal, of course, goes beyond just Red Fire. The dream of leaving the rat race to start a farm or otherwise live in harmony with the land is the perennial fantasy of the cubicle bound. In recent years, the New York Times, for example, has made great sport of telling the story of ex-bankers who head off to Vermont to start farms, stories that usually end with the banker slinking home, mud-stained hat in hand. Something about working outdoors, sun on your back, no computer screen in sight, is undeniably appealing. But why? This question motivated my visit to Red Fire. I was unlikely to move out to the country, but if I could isolate the underlying traits that attracted me to this lifestyle, I reasoned, I could perhaps then integrate some of these traits into my own life in the city. In other words, figuring out this appeal became a key goal in my quest to understand how people end up loving what they do. So I wrote Ryan and Sarah and asked if I could spend a day following them around. Once they agreed, I packed up my notebook, dusted off my work boots, and drove due west out of Boston. I was on a mission to crack the Red Fire Code. Cracking the Red Fire Code. Not long into my visit, I joined Ryan and Sarah for lunch at their farmhouse. Their kitchen was small but well used, packed with cookbooks and hand-labeled herb jars. They served bean sandwiches, open face on local 9-grain bread, and topped with thick-cut cheddar. As we ate, I asked Ryan how he ended up becoming a full-time farmer. I figured that if I wanted to understand what made his life appealing today, I needed to first understand how he got here. As you encountered in rule number 1 and rule number 2 of this book, by this point in my quest, I had developed an unconventional theory on how people end up loving what they do. I argued in rule number 1 that follow your passion is bad advice, as the vast majority of people don't have pre-existing passions waiting to be discovered and matched to a job. In rule number 2, I then countered that people with compelling careers instead start by getting good at something rare and valuable, building what I called career capital, and then cashing in this capital for the traits that make great work great. In this understanding, finding the right work pales in importance to working right. As Ryan told me his story over lunch, I was gratified to realize that his life provides a terrific case study of these ideas in action. To start, I'll emphasize that Ryan did not follow his passion into farming. Instead, like many people who end up loving what they do, he stumbled into his profession and then found that his passion for the work increased along with his expertise. Ryan grew up in Granby, but is not from a farming family. Growing up, I had little exposure to professional growing, he explained. In middle school, Ryan was drawn to a universal interest, making extra spending cash. This entrepreneurial streak led him to a series of schemes, from taking on a paper route to collecting cans for the local recycling center. His business breakthrough, however, came when he started collecting wild blueberries and selling them by the carton. I put up an umbrella next to the road, he told me, and started my first farm stand. This, he discovered, was a good way to make a buck. Ryan advanced from wild-picked berries to selling extra produce from his parents' backyard garden. Looking to increase revenue, he then talked his parents into letting him take over their garden. My dad was more than happy with that arrangement, he recalls. It was here that Ryan decided to get serious about career capital acquisition. I read everything about growing that I could get my hands on, zillions of different things, he told me. Soon, he expanded his parents' garden to cover most of the backyard, bringing in compost by the truckload to increase yield. By the time Ryan was in high school, he was renting 10 acres from a local farmer and hiring part-time help during the summer harvest. He took a loan from the Massachusetts Farm Services Agency to finance the purchase of an old tractor and expanded his business beyond his farm stand to also sell at a farmer's market and to a small number of wholesale clients. After graduating high school, Ryan headed off to Cornell's Agriculture College to further hone his skills with a degree in fruit and vegetable horticulture, returning home on the weekends in order to keep his rented fields healthy. Here's what struck me about Ryan's story. He didn't just decide one day that he was passionate about produce and then courageously head off into the countryside to start farming. Instead, by the time he made the plunge into full-time farming in 2001 when he bought his first land, he had been painstakingly acquiring relevant career capital for close to a decade. This might be less sexy than the daydream of quitting your day job one day and then waking up to the rooster's crow the next, but it matches what I consistently found when researching the previous two rules. You have to get good before you can expect good work. As lunch concluded, I had learned the Red Fire history, but I was still unclear on what exactly made its presence so appealing. As we left the kitchen to tour the farm, however, an insight began to develop. I noticed that as Ryan explained his crops, much of his early wariness fell away. Ryan is shy. When he talks in front of crowds, he tends to rush his sentences to completion, as if apologetic for interrupting. But once he got going on his farming strategies, explaining the difference between Merrimack sandy loam and Paxton silt loam, for example, or his new weeding strategy for the carrot beds, his shyness gave way to the enthusiasm of a craftsman who knows what he's doing and has been given the privilege to put this knowledge to work. I noticed a similar enthusiasm in Sarah when she discussed her efforts to manage the farm's CSA program and public image. When Sarah joined Ryan in Granby in 2007, she was already an advocate for both organic farming and community-supported agriculture. She had studied environmental policy at Vassar, where she'd stumbled on the college's Poughkeepsie Farm Project CSA. Inspired, she started her own small-scale CSA program after graduating in nearby Stafford Springs, Connecticut. Coming to Red Fire gave Sarah the opportunity to promote these beliefs on a larger scale, a challenge she clearly relishes. This, I came to realize, is what's so appealing about the Red Fire lifestyle. Control. Ryan and Sarah invested their extensive career capital into gaining control over what they do and how they do it. Their working lives aren't easy. If I learned anything from my visit to Red Fire, it's that farming is a complicated and stressful pursuit, but their lives are their own to direct, and they're good at this. In other words, the Red Fire appeal is not about working outside in the sun. To farmers, I learned, the weather is something to battle, not to enjoy. And it's not about getting away from the computer screen. Ryan spends all winter using Excel spreadsheets to plan his crop beds, while Sarah spends a healthy chunk of each day managing the farm operations on the office computer. It is instead autonomy that attracts the Granby groupies. Ryan and Sarah live a meaningful life on their own terms. As I'll argue next, control isn't just the source of Ryan and Sarah's appeal, but it turns out to be one of the most universally important traits that you can acquire with your career capital, something so powerful and so essential to the quest for work you love that I've taken to calling it the dream job elixir. The power of control. Ryan and Sarah have heaps of control in their working lives, and this is what makes the Red Fire lifestyle so appealing. The appeal of control, however, is not limited to farmers. Decades of scientific research have identified this trait as one of the most important you can pursue in the quest for a happier, more successful, and more meaningful life. Dan Pink's 2009 best-selling book, Drive, for example, reviews the dizzying array of different ways that control has been found to improve people's lives. As Pink summarizes the literature, more control leads to better grades, better sports performance, better productivity, and more happiness. In one such study mentioned in Pink's book, researchers at Cornell followed over 300 small businesses, half of which focused on giving control to their employees, and half which did not. The control-centric businesses grew at 4 times the rate of their counterparts. In another study, which I found during my own research, giving autonomy to middle school teachers in a struggling school district not only increased the rate at which the teachers were promoted, but also, to the surprise of the researchers, reversed the downward performance trend of their students. If you want to observe the power of control up close in the workplace, look toward companies embracing a radical new philosophy called Results-Only Work Environment, or ROW for short. In a ROW company, all that matters is your results. When you show up to work, and when you leave, when you take vacations, and how often you check email are all irrelevant. They leave it to the employee to figure out whatever works best for getting the important things done. No results, no job. It's that simple, as ROW supporters like to say. If you read the business case for Roe available online, you find example after example of employees liberated by control. At Best Buy's corporate headquarters, for example, the teams that implemented Roe saw the rate at which people left plummet by up to 90%. I love the Roe environment. It makes me feel like I'm in control of my destiny, said one Best Buy employee. At the Gap's headquarters, employees in a Roe pilot study found their happiness and performance improved. I've never seen my employees happier, said one manager. At a nonprofit organization in Redlands, California, the first nonprofit to embrace Roe, 80% of the employees reported feeling more engaged, while over 90% thought it made their life better, which is about as close to universal agreement as is possible in a work setting. And these are just a few examples among many. The more time you spend reading the research literature, the more it becomes clear. Giving people more control over what they do and how they do it increases their happiness, engagement, and sense of fulfillment. It's no wonder, then, that when you flip through your mental Rolodex of dream jobs, control is often at the core of their appeal. Throughout rule number 3, for example, you'll meet people in a variety of different fields who wielded control to create a working life they love. Among them is a freelance computer programmer who skips work to enjoy sunny days. A medical resident who took a 2-year leave from his elite residency program to start a company. And a famous entrepreneur who gave away his millions and sold his possessions to embrace an unencumbered, globe-trotting existence. These examples all have great lives, and as you'll learn, they all use control to create them. To summarize, if your goal is to love what you do, your first step is to acquire career capital. Your next step is to invest this capital in the traits that define great work. Control is one of the most important targets you can choose for this investment. Acquiring control, however, can be complicated. This is why I've dedicated the remainder of rule number 3 to this goal. In the chapters ahead, you'll follow me on my quest to find out more about this fickle trait. Chapter 9, The First Control Trap, in which I introduce the first control trap, which warns that it's dangerous to pursue more control in your working life before you have career capital to offer in exchange. Jane's Adventurous Vision. Jane understands the importance of control. She was a talented student who earned top 1% scores on her standardized tests and attended a competitive university, but she was also unhappy with following a traditional path from college and into a steady, well-paying job. Her vision for her life was more exotic. As an amateur athlete who once rode a bike across the country for charity and competed in an Ironman triathlon, she envisioned a more adventurous future. A copy of the life plan she sent me includes the goal of circumnavigating the world's oceans and traveling without motor power across every continent. Australia, by unicycle? Antarctica, by dog sled? The list also includes more eccentric goals, such as surviving in the wilderness with no tools or equipment for 1 month, and learning how to become a fire breather. To finance this adventurous life, her plan calls, vaguely, for her to build a set of low-maintenance websites that recurrently earn enough to support the pursuits on this list. Her goal was to get this revenue up to $3,000 a month, which she calculated to be enough to handle her basic expenses. Eventually, she planned to leverage these experiences to develop a nonprofit to develop my vision of health, human potential, and a life well lived. At first glance, Jane might remind you of Ryan and Sarah from Red Fire Farm. She recognized that gaining control over her life trumps simply gaining more income or prestige. Like Ryan trading in his diploma for farmland, this realization gave her the courage to step off a safe career path and instead pursue a more compelling existence. But unlike Ryan and Sarah, Jane's plans faltered. Soon after we met, she revealed that her embrace of control had led her to an extreme decision, dropping out of college. It didn't take long for her to realize that just because you're committed to a certain lifestyle doesn't mean you'll find people who are committed to supporting you. The current problem is financial independence, she told me. After quitting college, I started various businesses and launched freelance and blog projects, but lost motivation to continue before substantial results came. One of these experiments, a blog that she hoped to become the foundation of her empire of recurrent revenue generation, featured only 3 posts in 9 months. Jane had discovered a hard truth of the real world. It's really hard to convince people to give you money. I agree that it would be ideal to continue to develop my vision, she admitted. However, I also need money in order to eat. Without even a college degree to her name, finding this money was proving difficult. A commitment to dog sledding across Antarctica, it turns out, doesn't read well on a resume. Control requires capital. Control is seductive. As I discovered at Red Fire Farm, this trait defines the type of dream jobs that keeps cubicle dwellers up at night. It was this appeal that convinced Jane to leave her comfortable life as a student and pursue adventure. In doing so, however, she fell into a trap that threatens many in their quest for control. The first control trap. Control that's acquired without career capital is not sustainable. In rule number 2, I introduced the idea that career capital is the foundation for creating work you love. You must first generate this capital by becoming good at something rare and valuable, I argued. Then, invest it in the traits that help make great work great. In the last chapter, I argued that control is one of the most valuable traits you can invest in. Jane recognized the second part of this argument. Control is powerful. But she unfortunately skipped the first part. You need something valuable to offer in return for this powerful trait. In other words, she tried to obtain control without any capital to offer in return and ended up with a mere shadow of real autonomy. Ryan of Red Fire Farm, by contrast, avoided this trap by building up a decade's worth of relevant career capital before taking the dive into full-time farming. This trap might sound familiar, as we saw an example of it earlier in Rule Number 2, where I told the story of Lisa Feuer. As you'll recall, Feuer gave up her career in marketing and advertising to start a yoga business, even though her only training in yoga was a month-long certification course. Like Jane, she went after more control without the capital to back it up. Also like Jane, this path soon veered in a difficult direction. Within a year, Feuer was on food stamps. The more I studied examples of control, the more I encountered people who had made these same mistakes. Jane's story, for example, is just one of many from the growing lifestyle design community. This movement argues that you don't have to live life by other people's rules. It encourages its followers to design their own path through life, preferably one that's exciting and enjoyable to live. It's easy to find examples of this philosophy in action because many of its disciples blog about their exploits. At a high level, of course, there's nothing wrong with this philosophy. The author Timothy Ferris, who coined the term lifestyle design, is a fantastic example of the good things this approach to life can generate. Ferris has more than enough career capital to back up his adventurous existence. But if you spend time browsing the blogs of lesser-known lifestyle designers, you'll begin to notice the same red flags again and again. A distressingly large fraction of these contrarians, like Jane, skipped over the part where they build a stable means to support their unconventional lifestyle. They assume that generating the courage to pursue control is what matters, while everything else is just a detail that is easily worked out. One such blogger I found, to give another example among many, quit his job at the age of 25, explaining, "I was fed up with living a normal, conventional life, working 9 to 5 for the man and having no time and little money to pursue my true passions. So I've embarked on a crusade to show you and the rest of the world how an average Joe can build a business from scratch to support a life devoted to living the dream. The business he referenced, as is the case with many lifestyle designers, was his blog about being a lifestyle designer. In other words, his only product was his enthusiasm about not having a normal life. It doesn't take an economist to point out there's not much real value lurking there. Or, put into our terminology, enthusiasm alone is not rare and valuable and is therefore not worth much in terms of career capital. This lifestyle designer was investing in a valuable trait, but didn't have the means to pay for it. Not surprisingly, things soon turned bleak on this fellow's blog. After 3 months of posting several times a week about how to fund an unconventional life through blogging, even though he wasn't making any money himself from his own site, some frustration crept into his writing. In one post, he says, with evident exasperation, "What I noticed is that readers come and go. I've put in the hard yards, writing quality posts and finding awesome people, but alas, many of you just come and go. This is as annoying as trying to fill up a bucket with water that has a bunch of holes in it." He then goes on to detail his 10-point plan for building a more stable audience. The plan includes steps such as number 2, bring the energy, and number 4, shower your readers with appreciation. But the list still excludes the most important step of all, giving readers content they're willing to pay for. A few weeks later, the posts on the blog stopped. By the time I found it, there hadn't been a single new post in over 4 months. This story provides another clear example of the first control trap. If you embrace control without capital, you're likely to end up like Jane, Lisa, or our poor, frustrated lifestyle designer, enjoying all the autonomy you can handle, but unable to afford your next meal. This first trap, however, turns out to be only half of the story of why control can be a tricky trait to acquire. As I detail in the next chapter, even after you have the capital required to acquire real control, things remain difficult, as it's exactly at this point that people begin to recognize your value and start pushing back to keep you entrenched in a less autonomous path. Chapter 10, The Second Control Trap, in which I introduce the second control trap, which warns that once you have enough career capital to acquire more control in your working life, you have become valuable enough to your employer that they will fight your efforts to gain more autonomy. Why Lulu Keeps Turning Down Promotions. Lulu Young is a software developer, and she loves what she does. She lives in Roselindale, a close-in suburb of Boston, in a beautifully renovated duplex. When I met her there on a rainy spring day in 2011 to talk about work and control, she needed little prompting before diving into one of the more detailed autobiographies I had so far encountered in my quest. I can tell you, for example, that she scored a 5 on her AP chemistry test in high school, and that landing her first job involved a chance encounter with an old employer at a Bertucci's in Wellesley Hills. Here's what I wrote in my notes not long into the interview. This is someone who has put a lot of thought into her career. This thoughtfulness evidently paid off, as Lulu turned out to be one of the more confident and contented subjects I have encountered in my interviews. At the core of this contentment is control. Throughout her career, Lulu repeatedly fought to gain more freedom in her working life, sometimes to the shock or dismay of her employers or friends. "People tell me that I don't do things the way other people do," Lulu said. "But I tell them, I'm not other people." She succeeded in these fights, as you'll learn, because she was wary of the first control trap, which was described in the previous chapter. That is, she was careful to ensure she always had enough career capital to back her up before she made a bid for more control. This is a major reason that I want to tell her story. She provides a great example of control done right. Lulu's first job after graduating Wellesley College with a mathematics degree was at the bottom rung of the software development career ladder. She was working in quality assurance, QA, a fancy term for software tester. So your job would be, for example, to put text in bold and then make sure it worked? I asked her as she explained this first job. Whoa, let's not exaggerate the amount of responsibility they gave me, she joked in response. This was not a great job. In fact, this was not even a decent job. It's here that Lulu could have easily fallen into the first control trap. Finding yourself stuck in a boring job is exactly the point where breaking away to pave your own nonconformist path becomes tempting. Instead, she decided to acquire the career capital required to get somewhere better. Things played out as follows. Lulu began hacking the Unix operating system that ran the company's software. She eventually taught herself to build scripts that automated the testing, thus saving the company time and money. Her innovations attracted notice, and after a few short years, she was promoted to senior QA engineer. By this point, Lulu had built up a legitimate store of career capital, so she decided to see what it could buy her. To regain some autonomy from a succession of micromanaging bosses who had been tormenting her, she demanded a 30-hour-a-week schedule so she could pursue a part-time degree in philosophy from Tufts. I would have asked for less time, but 30 was the minimum for which you could still receive full benefits, she explained. If Lulu had tried this during her first year of employment, her bosses would have laughed and probably offered her instead a 0-hour-a-week schedule. But by the time she had become a senior engineer and was leading their testing automation efforts, they really couldn't say no. After she earned her degree, Lulu quit the company and brought her QA automation skills to a nearby startup that had just been acquired by a major firm. I had this spacious office with 3 computer screens, she recalls. Every week, the office manager would come by to take our candy order. You would tell her what candy you wanted, and it would show up on your desk. I had a lot of fun. After several years, the parent company of the startup decided to shut down the Boston area office, so Lulu, who had just bought a house, decided it was time for something different. When she re-entered the job market, she generated several offers, including one to manage the QA group for a large company. This would have been a big promotion for Lulu. More money, more power, and more prestige. The next step on a ladder to becoming a hotshot executive VP. Lulu turned it down. Instead, she took an offer to work with a 7-person startup founded by an old college friend's boyfriend that had jumped at the chance to acquire someone with such proven skills. I didn't really understand what they did, and I'm not sure they had it all figured out yet either, she told me. But this is exactly what made it appealing to Lulu. Tackling something brand new where there wasn't a detailed plan in place already seemed interesting. A pursuit where she would have a lot of say over what she did and how she did it. By the time this company was acquired in 2001, Lulu was the head software developer. Given this career capital, when she began to chafe at the new owner's regulations, a dress code, for example, plus insisting that all employees work between the hours of 9 and 5, she was able to demand and receive 3 months' leave. There will be no way for you to contact me during this period, she told her new bosses. The leave, it turned out, was also an excuse to train her staff to work without her. Soon after her leave ended, Lulu left, and in a bid for even more control, became a freelance software developer. At this point, her skills were so valuable that finding clients was no problem. More importantly, working as a contractor also gave her extreme flexibility in how she did her work. She would travel for 3 or 4 weeks at a time when she felt like getting away. If the weather was nice on a Friday, she told me, I would just take the day off to go flying. She obtained her pilot's license around this time. When she started work and when she ended her days were up to her. A lot of those days I would take a niece or nephew and have fun. I went to the Children's Museum and Zoo probably more than anybody else in the city, she recalls. They couldn't stop me from doing these things, as I was just a contractor. I interviewed Lulu early on a weekday afternoon, and the timing didn't seem to matter at all. Hold on, let me make sure Skype is turned off so no one can bother me, she told me soon after I arrived. Taking an afternoon off on a whim to do an interview is not the type of decision she could have gotten away with if she had followed a traditional career path to become a stock-owning, Porsche-driving, ulcer-suffering VP. But then again, stock-owning, Porsche-driving, ulcer-suffering VPs probably enjoy their lives quite a bit less than Lulu. Control generates resistance. Lulu's story, as I mentioned earlier, is an example of control done right. Like Ryan and Sarah of Red Fire Farms, her career is compelling because she has infused it with control over what she does and how she does it. Also, like Ryan and Sarah, she succeeds in this effort where others have failed. For example, Jane from the last chapter, by always making sure she has the career capital needed to obtain this autonomy. Lurking in this story, however, is a hidden danger. Although Lulu's career was satisfyingly self-directed, the path to acquiring this freedom generated conflict. Almost every time she invested her career capital to obtain the most control, she also encountered resistance. When she leveraged her value to obtain a 30-hour schedule at her first job, for example, her employer couldn't say no. She was saving them too much money. But they didn't like it. It took nerve on Lulu's part to push through that demand. Similarly, when she turned down a major promotion to take an ill-defined position at a 7-person startup, people in her life didn't understand. "You had just bought a house," I reminded her. To turn down a big important job to go work with an unknown little company, that's a big deal. "People thought I was nuts," she agreed. Leaving this startup after it was acquired was similarly difficult. Lulu was hesitant to get into details, but the subtext was that her value was so high at this company that its new owners tried every tactic they could to keep her on board. And finally, her transition to freelance work came with its own difficulties. Her first client really wanted to hire her full-time to work on the project, but she refused. "They really didn't want a contractor," she recalls. "But they didn't have anyone else who could do this type of work, so they eventually had no choice but to agree." The more I met people who successfully deployed control in their career, the more I heard similar tales of resistance from their employers, friends, and families. Another example is someone I'll call Lewis, who is a resident in a well-known combined plastic surgery program, which is arguably the most competitive medical residency. 3 years into his residency, he was starting to chafe under hospital bureaucracy. When I met him for coffee, he gave me a vivid example of the frustrations of life as a modern doctor. "I once received this patient in the ER who had his chest cut open because he had been stabbed in the heart," he told me. "I'm on the gurney, massaging his heart with my hands as he's brought into the operating room. We get to the room, and obviously this guy needs a blood transfusion because he has a hole in his heart." "Where's the blood?" I ask. "We can't give it to you," the tech replied. "You skipped registration when you came in. Remember, I literally had this guy's heart in my hand when we came through the door, and I was thinking, you've got to be freaking kidding me." That patient died in the OR. He probably would still have died even if he had been given a blood transfusion. But the point is that this was exactly the type of autonomy-demolishing experience that was eating away at Lewis. He craved more control in his life, so he did something unexpected. He took 2 years off from his residency program to start a company that builds online medical education tools. When you ask Lewis why he wanted to start a company, he paints a compelling picture. "One thing a lot of people struggle with in my field is that they have a lot of ideas, but don't know how to get them turned into reality." In his vision, he would become a doctor, but also be the co-founder of this company that would continue to run without requiring his day-to-day supervision. As he came up with ideas around medical education, an interest of his, he could then hand them over to the team at the company to be turned into reality. "Let's say I have this idea for a game that could help pre-med students learn some sort of new concept," he told me when I asked for an example. "I could turn to my team at the company and say, 'Go make this happen.'" To Lewis, there's a great sense of satisfaction in creating something that actually works, and this company would provide him that opportunity. As with Lulu, however, once Lewis had enough medical expertise to successfully raise the funding to begin this company, he had become valuable enough to his employer that they didn't want to let him go. He was the first person in the 10-year history of his combined plastic surgery program to request time off in the middle of his residency. "They were asking me, 'Why would you do this?'" he recalls. It was not an easy transition to make. When I met Lewis, however, his 2-year break was almost up. During this time, his company had progressed from an idea into a well-funded organization with a popular flagship product, a tool that helps med students prepare for their board exams, and a full-time staff that will keep things rolling as he returns to finish his residency. Lewis was clearly happy about his decision to push for something different, but it hadn't been easy. This is the irony of control. When no one cares what you do with your working life, you probably don't have enough career capital to do anything interesting. But once you do have this capital, as Lulu and Lewis discovered, you've become valuable enough that your employer will resist your efforts. This is what I came to think of as the second control trap. The second control trap. The point at which you have acquired enough career capital to get meaningful control over your working life is exactly the point when you become valuable enough to your current employer that they will try to prevent you from making the change. On reflection, this second trap makes sense. Acquiring more control in your working life is something that benefits you, but likely has no direct benefit to your employer. Downshifting to a 30-hour-per-week schedule, for example, provided Lulu freedom from a working environment that had felt increasingly stifling. But from the point of view of her employer, it was simply lost productivity. In other words, in most jobs, you should expect your employer to resist your move toward more control. They have every incentive to try to convince you to reinvest your career capital back into your career at their company, obtaining more money and prestige instead of more control. And this can be a hard argument to resist. Courage Revisited. Back in rule number 2, I was dismissive of the courage culture. This was my term for the growing number of authors and online commentators who promote the idea that the only thing standing between you and a dream job is building the courage to step off the expected path. I argued that it was this courage culture that led Lisa Feuer to quit her corporate job to chase an ill-fated yoga venture. This culture also plays a big role in egging on the less successful members of the lifestyle design community. In light of the second control trap, I need to moderate my previous disdain. Courage is not irrelevant to creating work you love. Lulu and Lewis, as we now understand, required quite a bit of courage to ignore the resistance generated by this trap. The key, it seems, is to know when the time is right to become courageous in your career decisions. Get this timing right, and a fantastic working life awaits you. But get it wrong by tripping the first control trap in a premature bid for autonomy, and disaster lurks. The fault of the courage culture, therefore, is not its underlying message that courage is good, but its severe underestimation of the complexity involved in deploying this boldness in a useful way. Imagine, for example, that you come up with an idea for injecting more control into your career. As I argued earlier, this is an idea worth paying attention to, because control is so powerful in transforming your working life that I call it the dream job elixir. Also imagine, however, that as you toy with this idea, people in your life start offering resistance. What's the right thing to do? The two control traps make this a hard question to answer. It's possible that you don't have enough career capital to back up this bid for more control. That is, you're about to fall into the first control trap. In this case, you should heed the resistance and shelve the idea. At the same time, however, it's possible that you have plenty of career capital, and this resistance is being generated exactly because you're so valuable. That is, you've fallen into the second control trap. In this case, you should ignore the resistance and pursue the idea. This, of course, is the problem with control. Both scenarios feel the same, but the right response is different in each. By this point in my quest, I've encountered enough stories of control going both right and wrong to know that this conundrum is serious, perhaps one of the single most difficult obstacles facing us in our quest for work we love. The cheery slogans of the courage culture are obviously too crude to guide us through this tricky territory. We need a more nuanced heuristic, something that could make clear exactly what brand of control trap you're facing. As you'll learn next, I ended up discovering this solution in the habits of an iconoclastic entrepreneur, someone who has elevated living his life by his own rules to an art form. Chapter 11, Avoiding the Control Traps, in which I explain the law of financial viability, which says you should only pursue a bid for more control if you have evidence that it's something that people are willing to pay you for. Derek Sivers is a control freak. Not long into his 2010 TED Talk on creativity and leadership, Derek Sivers plays a video clip of a crowd at an outdoor concert. A young man without a shirt starts dancing by himself. The audience members seated nearby look on curiously. "A leader needs the guts to stand alone and look ridiculous," Derek says. Soon, however, a second young man joins the first and starts dancing. Now comes the first follower with a crucial role. The first follower transforms the lone nut into a leader. As the video continues, a few more dancers join the group. Then several more. Around the 2-minute mark, the dancers have grown into a crowd. And ladies and gentlemen, that's how a movement is made. The TED audience gives Derek a standing ovation. He bows, then does a little dance himself on stage. No one can accuse Derek Sivers of being a conformist. During his career, he has repeatedly played the role of the first dancer. He starts with a risky move designed to maximize his control over what he does and how he does it. By doing so, he's at risk of looking like the lone nut dancing alone. Throughout Derek's career, however, there always ended up being a second dancer who validated his decision, and then eventually a crowd arrived, defining the move as successful. His first risky move occurred in 1992 when he quit a good job at Warner Brothers to pursue music full-time. He played guitar and toured with the Japanese musician and producer Ryuichi Sakamoto, and by all accounts was pretty good at it. His next big move was in 1997, when he started CD Baby, a company that helped independent artists sell their CDs online. In an age before iTunes, this company filled a crucial need for independent musicians, and the company grew. In 2008, he sold it to disc makers for $22 million. At this point in his career, conventional wisdom dictated that Derek should move to a large house outside of San Francisco and become an angel investor. But Derek was never interested in conventional wisdom. Instead, he put all of the proceeds from the sale into a charitable trust to support music education, living off the smallest possible amount of interest allowed by law. He then sold his possessions and began traveling the world in search of an interesting place to live. When I spoke with him, he was in Singapore. "I love that the country has so little gravity. It doesn't try to hold you here. It's instead a base from which you can go explore," he said. When I asked him why he's living overseas, he replied, "I follow a rule with my life that if something is scary, do it. I've lived everywhere in America, and for me, a big scary thing was living outside the country." After taking time off to read, learn Mandarin, and travel the world, Derek has recently turned his sights on a new company, Muckwork. This service allows musicians to outsource boring tasks so they can spend more time on the creative things that matter. He started the company because he thought the idea sounded fun. Here's what interests me about Derek. He loves control. His whole career has been about making big moves, often in the face of resistance, to gain more control over what he does and how he does it. And not only does he love control, but he's fantastically successful at achieving it. This is why I got him on the phone from Singapore. I wanted to find out how he achieved this feat. In more detail, I asked what criteria he uses to decide which projects to pursue and which to abandon. In essence, I wanted his map for navigating the control traps described in the last two chapters. Fortunately for us, he had a simple but surprisingly effective answer to my question. The Law of Financial Viability. When I explained what I was after, Derek got it right away. You mean the type of mental algorithm that prevents the lawyer who has had this successful career for 20 years from suddenly saying, "You know, I love massages. I'm going to become a masseuse," he asked. "That's it," I replied. Derek thought for a moment. "I have this principle about money that overrides my other life rules," he said. "Do what people are willing to pay for." Derek made it clear that this is different from pursuing money for the sake of having money. Remember, this is someone who gave away $22 million and sold his possessions after his company was acquired. Instead, as he explained, money is a neutral indicator of value. By aiming to make money, you're aiming to be valuable. He also emphasized that hobbies are clearly exempt from this rule. If I want to learn to scuba dive, for example, because I think it's fun and people won't pay me to do that, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway, he said. But when it comes to decisions affecting your core career, money remains an effective judge of value. If you're struggling to raise money for an idea or are thinking that you will support your idea with unrelated work, then you need to rethink the idea. At first encounter, Derek's career, which orbits around creative pursuits, might seem divorced from matters as prosaic and crass as money. But when he re-narrated his path from the perspective of this mental algorithm, it suddenly made more sense. His first big move, for example, was to become a professional musician in 1992. As Derek explained to me, he started by pursuing music at night and on the weekend. "I didn't quit my day job until I was making more money with my music." His second big move was to start CD Baby. Again, he didn't turn his attention full-time to this pursuit until after he had built up a profitable client base. "People ask me how I funded my business," he said. "I tell them, first I sold one CD, which gave me enough money to sell two." It grew from there. In hindsight, Derek's bids for control remain big and nonconformist. But given his mental algorithm on only doing what people are paying for, they now also seem much less risky. This idea is powerful enough that I should give it its own official-sounding title: The Law of Financial Viability. When deciding whether to follow an appealing pursuit that will introduce more control into your work life, seek evidence of whether people are willing to pay for it. If you find this evidence, continue. If not, move on. When I began reflecting on this law, I saw that it applied again and again to examples of people successfully acquiring more control in their careers. To understand this, notice that the definition of willing to pay varies. In some cases, it literally means customers paying you money for a product or a service. But it can also mean getting approved for a loan, receiving an outside investment, or, more commonly, convincing an employer to either hire you or keep writing you paychecks. Once you adopt this flexible definition of pay for it, this law starts popping up all over. Consider, for example, Ryan Voiland from Red Fire Farm. Many well-educated city dwellers, fed up with urban chaos, buy some farmland and try to make a living working with their hands. Most fail. What makes Ryan different is that he made sure people were willing to pay him to farm before he tried it. In more detail, because he wasn't a rich ex-banker, buying his first property required a loan from the Massachusetts Farm Services Agency, and the FSA does not give away its money easily. You have to submit a detailed business plan that convinces them that you'll actually make money with your farm. With 10 years of experience on his side, Ryan was able to make this argument. Lulu provides another good example of this law in action. Here, the definition of willing to pay concerned her paycheck. She judged her moves toward more autonomy by whether or not someone would hire her or keep paying her while she made them. Her first big move, for example, was to drop to a 30-hour-per-week schedule. She knew she had enough capital to support this change because her employer said yes. In later jobs, when she negotiated a 3-month leave or insisted on working freelance with an open schedule, these were also bids for more control that were validated by the fact that her employers accepted them. If she had had less career capital, they would have had no problem telling her goodbye. On the flip side, when you look at stories of people who were unsuccessful in adding more control to their careers, you often find that the